been understood to some extent, but not fully, and would have put a few more questions when suddenly everyone began talking and making a noise, and they moved toward the big room. What is it? Hey? Whom? Proxy? Whose? What? They won't pass him? No proxy? They won't let Gliarov in? A, because of the charge against him? Why, at this rate, they won't admit anyone. It's a swindle. The law. Levin heard exclamations on all sides, and he moved into the big room together with the others, all hurrying somewhere and afraid of missing something. Squeezed by the crowding noblemen, he drew near the high table where the marshal of the province, Sviashki, and the other leaders were hotly disputing about something. Chapter 28. Levin was standing rather far off, a nobleman breathing heavily and hoarsely at his side, and another whose thick boots were creaking prevented him from hearing distinctly. He could only hear the soft voice of the marshal faintly, then the shrill voice of the venomous gentleman, and then the voice of Sviashki. They were disputing, as far as he could make out, as to the interpretation to be put on the act and the exact meaning of the words, liable to be called up for trial. The crowd parted to make way for Sergei Ivanovich, approaching the table. Sergei Ivanovich, waiting till the venomous gentleman had finished speaking, said that he thought the best solution would be to refer to the act itself, and asked the secretary to find the act. The act said that in case of difference of opinion, there must be a ballot. Sergei Ivanovich read the act and began to explain its meaning, but at that point a tall, stout, stoop-shouldered landowner with dyed mustache in a tight uniform that made the back of his neck bulge up interrupted him. He went up to the table, and striking it with his finger ring, he shouted loudly, "A ballot! Put it to the vote! No need for more talking!" Then several voices began to talk all at once, and the tall nobleman with the ring, getting more and more exasperated, shouted more and more loudly, but it was impossible to make out what he said. He was shouting for the very course Sergei Ivanovich had proposed, but it was evident that he hated him and all his party, and this feeling of hatred spread through the whole party and roused in opposition to it the same vindictiveness, though in a more seemly form on the other side. Shouts were raised, and for a moment all was confusion, so that the marshal of the province had to call for order. "A ballot, a ballot. Whoever is a nobleman understands. We shed our blood for our country, the confidence of the monarch. No checking of the accounts of the marshal. He's not a cashier. But that's not the point. Votes, please. What vileness!" Shouted furious and violent voices on all sides. Looks and faces were even more violent and furious than their words. They expressed the most implacable hatred. Levin did not in the least understand what it was all about, and he marveled at the passion with which it was disputed whether or not the decision about Gliarov should be put to the vote. He forgot, as Sergei Ivanovich explained to him afterward, this syllogism, that it was necessary for the public good to get rid of the marshal of the province, that to get rid of the marshal it was necessary to have a majority of votes, that to get a majority of votes it was necessary to secure Gliarov's right to vote, that to secure the recognition of Gliarov's right to vote they must decide on the interpretation to be put on the act. And one vote may decide the whole question, and one must be serious and consecutive if one wants to be of use in public life, concluded Sergei Ivanovich. But Levin forgot all that, and it was painful to him to see all these excellent persons for whom he had respect in such an unpleasant and vicious state of excitement. To escape from this painful feeling, he went away into the other room where there was nobody except the waiters at the refreshment bar. Seeing the waiters busy washing up the crockery and setting in order their plates and wine glasses, seeing their alert and vivacious faces, Levin felt an unexpected sense of relief, as though he had come out of a stuffy room into the fresh air. He began walking up and down, looking with pleasure at the waiters. He particularly liked the way one gray-whiskered waiter, who showed his scorn for the other younger ones and was jeered at by them, was teaching them how to fold napkins properly. Levin was just about to enter into conversation with the old waiter when the secretary of the court of wardship, a little old man whose specialty it was to know all the noblemen of the province by name and patronymic, drew him away. "Please come, Konstantin Dmitrievich," he said. "Your brother's looking for you. They are voting on the legal point." Levin walked into the room, received a white ball, and followed his brother, Sergei Ivanovich, to the table where Sviashsky was standing with a significant and ironical face, holding his beard in his fist and sniffing at it. Sergei Ivanovich put his hand into the box, put the ball somewhere, and making room for Levin, stopped. Levin advanced, but utterly forgetting what he was to do and much embarrassed, he turned to Sergei Ivanovich with the question, "Where am I to put it?" He asked this softly at a moment when there was talking going on near, so that he had hoped his question would not be overheard. But the person speaking paused, and his improper question was overheard. Sergei Ivanovich frowned. "That is a matter for each man's own decision," he said severely. Several people smiled. Levin crimsoned, hurriedly thrust his hand under the cloth, and put the ball to the right, as it was in his right hand. Having put it in, he recollected that he ought to have thrust his left hand in too, and so he thrust it in, though too late. And still more overcome with confusion, he beat a hasty retreat into the background. 126 for admission, 98 against, sang out the voice of the secretary, who could not pronounce the letter R. Then there was a laugh, a button, and two hazelnuts were found in the box. The nobleman was allowed the right to vote, and the new party had conquered. But the old party did not consider themselves conquered. Levin heard that they were asking Snetkov to be candidate, and he saw that a crowd of noblemen were surrounding the marshal, who was saying something. Levin went nearer. In reply, Snetkov spoke of the trust of the noblemen of the province had placed in him, the affection they had shown him, which he did not deserve, as his only merit had been his attachment to the nobility, to whom he had devoted 12 years of service. Several times he repeated the words, "I have served to the best of my powers with truth and good faith. I value your goodness and thank you." And suddenly he stopped short from the tears that choked him and went out of the room. Whether these tears came from a sense of the injustice being done him, from his love for the nobility, or from the strain of the position he was placed in, feeling himself surrounded by enemies, his emotion infected the assembly. The majority were touched, and Levin felt a tenderness for Snetkov. In the doorway, the marshal of the province jostled against Levin. "Beg pardon, excuse me, please," he said, as to a stranger, but recognizing Levin, he smiled timidly. It seemed to Levin that he would have liked to say something, but could not speak for emotion. His face and his whole figure in his uniform with the crosses and white trousers striped with galloons, as he moved hurriedly along, reminded Levin of some hunted beast who sees that he is in evil flight. This expression on the marshal's face was particularly touching to Levin because only the day before he had been at his house about his guardianship business and had seen him in all his grandeur, a kind-hearted, fatherly man. The big house with the old family furniture, the rather slovenly, far from stylish, but respectful footman, unmistakably old house serfs who had stuck to their master, the stout, good-natured wife in a cap with lace and a Turkish shawl, petting her pretty grandchild, her daughter's daughter, the young son, a sixth-form high school boy, coming home from school and greeting his father by kissing his big hand, the genuine, cordial words and gestures of the old man, all this had the day before aroused an instinctive feeling of respect and sympathy in Levin. This old man was a touching and pathetic figure to Levin now, and he longed to say something pleasant to him. "So, you're our marshal again," he said. "It's not likely," said the marshal, looking round with a scared expression. "I'm worn out, I'm old, If there are men younger and more deserving than I, let them serve. And the marshal disappeared through a side door. The most solemn moment was at hand. They were to proceed immediately to the election. The leaders of both parties were reckoning white and black on their fingers. The discussion upon Fliorov had given the new party not only Fliorov's vote, but had also gained time for them, so that they could send to fetch three noblemen who had been rendered unable to take part in the election by the wiles of the other party. Two noble gentlemen who had a weakness for strong drink had been made drunk by the partisans of Snetkov, and a third had been relieved of his uniform. On learning this, the new party had made haste, during the dispute about Fliorov, to send some of their men in a cab to clothe the stripped gentleman and to bring along one of the intoxicated to the meeting. I brought one after bringing him to by throwing water over him, said the landowner, who had gone on this errand to Sviazhsky. Never mind, he'll do. Not too drunk, he won't fall down, said Sviazhsky, shaking his head. No, he's first rate. If only they don't give him any more here. I've told the barman not to give him anything, on any account. Chapter 29. The narrow room in which they were smoking and taking refreshment was full of noblemen. The excitement grew more intense, and every face betrayed some uneasiness. The excitement was especially keen for the leaders of each party, who knew every detail and had reckoned up every vote. They were the generals organizing the approaching battle. The rest, like the rank and file before an engagement, though they were getting ready for the fight, sought for other distractions in the interval. Some were lunching, standing at the bar, or sitting at the table. Others were walking up and down the long room, smoking cigarettes, and talking with friends whom they had not seen for a long while.
Levin did not care to eat, and he was not a smoker. He did not want to join his own friends, that is, Sergei Ivanovich, Stepan Arkadyevich, Sviazhsky, and the rest, because Vronsky, in his equerry's uniform, was standing with them in eager conversation. Levin had seen him already at the meeting on the previous day, and he had studiously avoided him, not caring to greet him. He went to the window and sat down, scanning the groups and listening to what was being said around him. He felt depressed, especially because everyone else was, as he saw, eager, anxious, and interested, and he alone, with an old, toothless little man with mumbling lips, wearing a naval uniform, who sat beside him, had no interest in it and nothing to do. He's such a blackguard. I have told him so, but it makes no difference. Only think of it. He couldn't collect it in 3 years, he heard vigorously uttered by a stoop-shouldered, short country gentleman who had pomaded hair hanging over his embroidered collar and new boots obviously put on for the occasion, with heels that tapped energetically as he spoke. Casting a displeased glance at Levin, this gentleman sharply turned his back. Yes, it's a dirty business, there's no denying, another puny landowner assented in a high voice. Next, a whole crowd of country gentlemen surrounding a stout general hurriedly came near Levin. These persons were unmistakably seeking a place where they could talk without being overheard. How dare he say, I had his breeches stolen. Pawned them for drink, I expect. Damn the fellow, prince indeed. He better not say it. That's swinish. But excuse me, they take their stand on the act, was being said in another group. The wife must be registered as a noble. Oh, damn your acts. I speak from my heart. We're all gentlemen, aren't we? Have trust in us. Shall we go on, Your Excellency? Fine champagne. Another group was following a nobleman who was shouting something in a loud voice. It was one of the three intoxicated gentlemen. I always advised Maria Semyonovna to let for a fair rent, for she can never save a profit, he heard a pleasant voice say. The speaker was a country gentleman with white mustache, wearing the regimental uniform and an old general staff officer. It was the very landowner Levin had met at Sviazhsky's. He knew him at once. The landowner, too, stared at Levin, and they exchanged greetings. Very glad to see you, to be sure. I remember you very well. Last year at our district marshal's, Nikolai Ivanovich's. Well, and how is your land doing? Asked Levin. Oh, still just the same, always at a loss, the landowner answered with a resigned smile, but with an expression of serenity and conviction that it must be thus. And how do you come to be in our province? He asked. Come to take part in our coup d'etat, he said, confidently pronouncing the French words with a bad accent. All Russia's here, gentlemen of the bedchamber and everything short of the ministry. He pointed to the imposing figure of Stepan Arkadyevich in white trousers and his court uniform, walking by with the general. I ought to own that I don't very well understand the drift of the provincial elections, said Levin. The landowner looked at him. Why, what is there to understand? There's no meaning in it at all. It's a decaying institution that goes on running only by the force of inertia. Just look. The very uniforms tell you that it's an assembly of justices of the peace, permanent members of the boards, and so on, but not of noblemen. Then why do you come, asked Levin? From habit, nothing else. Then, too, one must keep up connections. It's a moral obligation of a sort. And then, to tell the truth, there are one's own interests. My son-in-law wants to run as a permanent member. They're not rich people, and he must be brought forward. These gentlemen now, what do they come for? He said, pointing to the venomous gentleman who was talking at the high table. That's the new generation of nobility. New it may be, but nobility it isn't. They're landed proprietors, but we're the landowners. As noblemen, they're cutting their own throats. But you say it's an institution that served its time. That it may be, but still it ought to be treated a little more respectfully. Snetkov, now, we may be of use, or we may not, but we're the growth of 1,000 years. If we're laying out a garden, planting one before the house, you know, and there you've a tree that stood for centuries in the very spot, old and gnarled it may be, and yet you don't cut down the old fellow to make room for the flower beds, but lay out your beds so as to take advantage of the tree. You won't grow him again in a year, he said cautiously, and he immediately changed the conversation. Well, and how is your estate doing? Oh, not very well. I make about 5%. Yes, but you don't reckon your own work. Aren't you worth something, too? I'll tell you my own case. Before I took to seeing after the land, I had a salary of 3,000 rubles from the service. Now I do more work than I did in the service, and like you, I get 5% on the land, and thank God for that. But one's work is thrown in for nothing. Then why do you do it, if it's a clear loss? Oh, well, one does it. What would you have? It's habit, and one knows it's as it should be. And what's more, the landowner went on, leaning on the window and chatting on, my son, I must tell you, has no taste for it. There's no doubt he'll be a savant, so there'll be no one to keep it up. And yet, one does it. Here, this year, I've planted an orchard. Yes, yes, said Levin, that's perfectly true. I always feel there's no real balance of gain in my work on the land, and yet one does it. It's a sort of duty one feels to the land. But I tell you what, the landowner pursued. A neighbor of mine, a merchant, was at my place. We walked about the fields in the park. No, said he, Stepan Vasilievich, everything's well looked after, but your garden's neglected. But as a fact, it's well kept up. To my thinking, I'd cut down the linden trees. Only do it when they're running sap. Here's 1,000 lindens, and each would make 2 good bundles of bast. And nowadays, that bast's worth something, and you'd cut down the lot of the linden shells. And with what he made, he'd buy up livestock, or buy some land for a trifle, and let it out to the peasants, Levin added, smiling. He had evidently more than once come across those commercial calculations. And he'd make his fortune. But you and I must thank God if we keep what we've got and leave it to our children. You're married, I've heard, said the landowner. Yes, Levin answered with proud satisfaction. Yes, all this is rather strange, he went on. So we live on without any reckoning, as though we were the vessels of antiquity, set to guard a sacred fire or something. The landowner chuckled under his white mustaches. There are some among us, too, like our friend Nikolai Ivanovich, or Count Vronsky, who settled here lately. They tried to set up an agronomic industry, but so far it leads to nothing but making away with capital. But why is it we don't do like the merchants? Why don't we cut down our parks for bass? Said Levin, returning to a thought that had struck him. Why, as you said, to guard the fire? Decide that's not work for a nobleman. And our work as noblemen isn't done here at the elections, but yonder, each in his own nook. There's a class instinct, too, of what one ought and oughtn't to do. There are the peasants, too. I wonder at them sometimes. Any good peasant tries to take all the land he can. However bad the land is, he'll work it, without a reckoning, too, at a simple loss. Just as we do, said Levin. Very, very glad to have met you, he added, seeing Sviazhsky approaching him. And here we've met for the first time since we met at your place, said the landowner to Sviazhsky. And we had a good talk, too. Well, have you been attacking the new order of things, said Sviazhsky with a smile. That we're bound to do. You've been relieving your feelings. Chapter 30. Sviazhsky took Levin's arm and went with him to his own friends. This time there was no avoiding Vronsky. He was standing with Stepan Arkadyevich and Sergei Ivanovich, and looking straight at Levin as he drew near. Delighted, I believe I've had the pleasure of meeting you at Princess Shcherbatskaya's, he said, giving Levin his hand. Yes, I quite remember our meeting, said Levin, and blushing crimson he turned away immediately and began talking to his brother. With a slight smile, Vronsky went on talking to Sviazhsky, obviously without the slightest inclination to enter into conversation with Levin. But Levin, as he talked to his brother, was continually looking round at Vronsky, trying to think of something to say to him to smooth over his rudeness. What are we waiting for now? Asked Levin, looking at Sviazhsky and Vronsky. For Snetkov. He has to refuse or accept the candidacy, answered Sviazhsky. Well, and what has he done, consented or not? That's the point. He's done neither, said Vronsky. And if he refuses, who will run then? Asked Levin, looking at Vronsky. Whoever chooses to, said Sviazhsky. Shall you? Asked Levin. Certainly not I, said Sviazhsky, looking confused and turning an alarmed glance at the venomous gentleman who was standing beside Sergei Ivanovich. Who then? Nevyedovsky, said Levin, feeling he was putting his foot into it. But this was worse still. Nevyedovsky and Sviazhsky were the two candidates. I certainly shall not, under any circumstances, answered the venomous gentleman. This was Nevyedovsky himself. Sviazhsky introduced him to Levin. Well, do you find it exciting, too? Asked Stepan Arkadyevich, winking at Vronsky. It's something like a race. One might bet on it. Yes, it is keenly exciting, said Vronsky. And once taking the thing up, one's eager to see it through. It's a fight, he said, scowling and setting his powerful jaws. What a businessman Sviazhsky is. See it all so clearly. Oh, yes, Vronsky assented indifferently. A silence followed, during which Vronsky, since he had to look at something, looked at Levin, at his feet, at his frock coat, then at his face, and noticing his gloomy eyes fixed upon him, he said, in order to say something, how is it that you, living constantly in the country, are not a justice of the peace? You are not in the uniform of one. It's because I consider the justice of the peace a silly institution, morosely answered Levin, who had been all the time looking for an opportunity to enter into conversation with Vronsky so as to smooth over his rudeness at their first meeting. I don't think so. Quite the contrary, Vronsky said with calm surprise. It's a plaything, Levin cut him short. We don't want justices of the peace. I've never had a single thing to do with them during 8 years, and what I have had was decided wrongly by them. The justice of the peace is over 30 miles from me. For a matter of 2 rubles or so, I should have to send a lawyer who cost me 15. And he related how a peasant had stolen some flour from the miller, and when the miller told him of it, had lodged a complaint for slander. All this was utterly uncalled for and stupid, and Levin felt it himself as he said it. Oh, this is such an original fellow, said Stepan Arkadyevich with his most soothing almond oil smile. But come along, I think they're voting. And they separated. I can't understand, said Sergey Ivanovich, who had observed his brother's gaucherie. I can't understand how anyone can be so absolutely devoid of political tact. That's where we Russians are so deficient. The marshal of the province is our opponent, and with him you're a me cochon, and you beg him to be a candidate? Count Vronsky, no. I'm not making a friend of him. He's asked me to dinner, and I'm not going. But he's one of our side. Why make an enemy of him? Then you ask Nevyedovsky if he's going to run. That's not done. Oh, I don't understand it at all, and it's all such nonsense, Levin answered somberly. You say it's all such nonsense, yet as soon as you have anything to do with it, you make a muddle. Levin did not answer, and they walked together into the big room. The marshal of the province, though he was vaguely conscious in the air of some trap being prepared for him, and though he had not been called upon by all to run, had nevertheless made up his mind to run for office. All was silence in the room. The secretary announced in a loud voice that Mikhail Stepanovich Snetkov, captain of the guards, would now be balloted for as marshal of the province. The district marshals walked, carrying plates on which were balls, from their tables to the province table, and the election began. Put it in the right side, whispered Stepan Arkadyevich, as Levin, with his brother, followed the marshal of his district to the table. But Levin had forgotten by now the machination that had been explained to him, and was afraid Stepan Arkadyevich might be mistaken in saying the right side. Surely Snetkov was the enemy. As he went up, he held the ball in his right hand, but thinking he was wrong, just as the box, he changed to the left hand and undoubtedly put the ball to the left. An adept in the business, standing at the box and seeing by the mere action of the elbow where each put his ball, scowled with annoyance. It was no good for him to use his insight. Everything was still and the counting of the balls was heard. Then a single voice rose and proclaimed the number for and against. The marshal had been voted for by a considerable majority. All was noise and eager movement toward the doors. Snetkov came in, and the nobles thronged round him, congratulating him. Well now, is it over? Levin asked Sergey Ivanovich. It's only just beginning, Sviazhsky said, replying for Sergey Ivanovich with a smile. Some other candidate may receive more votes than the marshal. Levin had quite forgotten about that again. Now he could only remember that there was some sort of trickery in it, but he was too bored to think what it was exactly. He felt depressed and longed to get out of the crowd. As no one was paying any attention to him, and no one apparently needed him, he quietly slipped away into the little room where the refreshments were, and again had a great sense of comfort when he saw the waiters. The little old waiter pressed him to have something, and Levin agreed. After eating a cutlet of beans and talking to the waiters of their former masters, Levin, not wishing to go back to the hall, where it was also distasteful to him, proceeded to walk through the galleries. The galleries were full of fashionably dressed ladies leaning over the balustrade and trying not to lose a single word of what was being said below. With the ladies were sitting and standing smart lawyers, high school teachers in spectacles, and officers. Everywhere they were talking of the election and of how worried the marshal was and how splendid the discussions had been. In one group, Levin heard his brother's praises. One lady was telling a lawyer, "How glad I am I heard Koznishev. It's worth missing one's lunch. He's exquisite, so clear and distinct, all of it. There's not one of you in the law courts that speaks like that. The only one is Meidel, and he's very far from being so eloquent." Finding a free place, Levin leaned over the balustrade and began looking and listening. All the noblemen were sitting railed off behind barriers according to their districts. In the middle of the room stood a man in a uniform who shouted in a loud, high voice, "As a candidate for the marshalship of the nobility of the province, we call upon Staff Captain Eugeny Ivanovich Apukhtin." A dead silence followed, and then a weak old voice was heard, declined. "We call upon the Privy Councillor, Peter Petrovich Bol," the voice began again. "Declined," a high boyish voice replied. Then it began, and again came the decline. And so it went on for about an hour. Levin, with his elbows on the balustrade, looked and listened. At first he wondered and wanted to know what it meant. Then, feeling sure that he could not make it out, he began to be bored. Then, recalling all the excitement and vindictiveness he had seen on all the faces, he felt sad. He made up his mind to go and went downstairs. As he passed through the entry to the galleries, he met a dejected high school boy walking up and down with tired-looking eyes. On the stairs he met a couple, a lady running quickly on her high heels, and the jaunty deputy prosecutor. "I told you you weren't late," the deputy prosecutor was saying at the moment when Levin moved aside to let the lady pass. Levin was on the stairs to the way out and was just feeling in his waistcoat pocket for his overcoat check when the secretary overtook him. "This way, please, Konstantin Dmitrich. They are voting." The candidate who was being voted on was Nevyedovsky, who had so stoutly denied all idea of candidacy. Levin went up to the door of the room. It was locked. The secretary knocked, the door opened, and Levin was met by two red-faced gentlemen who darted out. "I can't stand any more of it," said one red-faced gentleman. After them, the face of the marshal of the province was poked out. His face was dreadful-looking from exhaustion and dismay. "I told you not to let anyone out," he cried to the doorkeeper. "I let someone in, Your Excellency." "Mercy on us." And with a heavy sigh, the marshal of the province walked with downcast head to the high table in the middle of the room, his white trouser legs wavering from fatigue. Nevyedovsky had scored a higher majority as they had planned, and he was the new marshal of the province. Many people were amused, many were pleased and happy, many were in ecstasies, many were disgusted and unhappy. The former marshal of the province was in a state of despair which he could not conceal. When Nevyedovsky went out of the room, the crowd thronged round him and followed him enthusiastically, just as they had followed the governor on the first day when he had opened the meeting, and just as they had followed Snetkov when he had been elected. Chapter 31. The newly elected marshal and many of the successful party dined that day with Vronsky. Vronsky had come to the elections partly because he was bored in the country and wanted to show Anna his right to independence, and also to repay Sviatsky by his support at the election for all the trouble he had taken for Vronsky at the Zemstvo election, but chiefly for the strict performance of all those duties of a nobleman and landowner which he had taken upon himself. But he had not in the least expected that the election would interest him so keenly excite him, and that he would be so good at this kind of thing. He was quite a new man in the circle of the nobility of the province, but his success was unmistakable, and he was not wrong in supposing that he had already obtained a certain influence. This influence was due to his wealth and aristocracy. The capital house in the town lent him by his old friend Shirkov, who had a post in the Department of Finances and was director of a flourishing bank in Kashin. The excellent cook Vronsky had brought from the country, and his friendship with the governor, who was a schoolfellow of Vronsky, a schoolfellow he had patronized and protected indeed. But what contributed more than all to his success was his direct, equable manner with everyone, which very quickly made the majority of the noblemen reverse the current opinion of his supposed haughtiness. He was himself conscious that, except for that mad gentleman married to Kitty Sherbiatskaya, who had apropos de bottles poured out a stream of irrelevant absurdities with such spiteful fury, every nobleman with whom he had made acquaintance had become his adherent. He saw clearly, and other people recognized it too, that he had done a great deal to secure the success of Nevyedovsky. And now at his own table, celebrating Nevyedovsky's election, he was experiencing an agreeable sense of triumph over the success of his candidate. The election itself had so fascinated him that, if he could succeed in getting married during the next 3 years, he began to think of running for office himself, much as, after winning a race ridden by a jockey, he had longed to ride a race himself. Today he was celebrating the success of his jockey. Vronsky sat at the head of the table. On his right hand sat the young governor, a general of high rank. To all the rest, he was the master of the province, who had solemnly opened the elections with his speech and aroused a feeling of respect and even of awe in many people, as Vronsky saw. To Vronsky, he was Katka Maslov. That had been his nickname in the page's corps, whom he felt to be shy and tried to put at ease. On the left hand sat Nevyedovsky with his youthful, stubborn, and venomous countenance. With him, Vronsky was simple and deferential. Sviatsky took his failure very lightheartedly. It was indeed no failure in his eyes, as he said himself, turning, glass in hand, to Nevyedovsky. They could not have found a better representative of the new movement, which the nobility ought to follow. And so every honest person, as he said, was on the side of today's success and was celebrating over it. Stepan Arkadyevich was glad, too, because he was having a good time and because everyone was pleased. The episodes of the election served as a good occasion for a capital dinner. Sviatsky comically imitated the cheerful discourse of Marshall and observed, addressing Nevyedovsky, that His Excellency would have to select another, more complicated method of auditing accounts than tears. Another nobleman jocosely described how footmen in stockings had been imported for the marshal's ball, and how now they would have to be sent back unless a new marshal would give a ball with footmen in stockings. Continually during dinner they said of Nevyedovsky, "Our marshal and Your Excellency." This was said with the same pleasure with which a young wife is called madam by her husband's name. Nevyedovsky affected to be not merely indifferent but scornful to this appellation, but it was obvious that he was highly delighted and had to keep a curb on himself not to betray the triumph, which was unsuitable to their new liberal party. In the course of dinner, several telegrams were sent to people interested in the result of the election, and Stepan Arkadyevich, who was in high spirits, sent Darya Alexandrovna a telegram. Nevyedovsky elected by 20 votes. Congratulations. Tell people. He dictated it aloud, saying, "We must let them share our rejoicing." Darya Alexandrovna, getting the message, simply sighed over the ruble wasted on it and understood that it was an after-dinner affair. She knew Stiva had a weakness after dining for fair genre. The telegraph. Everything together with the excellent dinner and the wine, not from Russian merchants, but imported direct from abroad, was extremely dignified, simple, and enjoyable. The party, some 20, had been selected by Sviatsky from among the more active new liberals, all of the same way of thinking, who were at the same time clever and well-bred. They drank, also half in jest, to the health of the new marshal of the province, of the governor, of the bank director, and of our amiable host. Vronsky was satisfied. He had never expected to find so pleasant a tone in the provinces. Toward the end of dinner, it was still more lively. The governor asked Vronsky to come to a concert for the benefit of the brethren, which his wife, who was anxious to make his acquaintance, had been getting up. "There'll be a ball, and you'll see the belle of the province. Worth seeing, really." "Not in my line," Vronsky answered. He liked that English phrase, but he smiled and promised to come. Before they rose from the table, when all of them were smoking, Vronsky's valet went up to him with a letter on a tray. "Special messenger," he said, with a significant expression. "Astonishing how like he is to the deputy prosecutor Svetitsky," said one of the guests in French of the valet, while Vronsky, frowning, read the letter. The letter was from Anna. Before he read the letter, he knew its contents. Expecting the elections to be over in 5 days, he had promised to be back on Friday. Today was Saturday, and he knew that the letter contained reproaches for not being back at the time fixed. The letter he had sent the previous evening had probably not reached her yet. The letter was what he had expected, but the form of it was unexpected and particularly disagreeable to him. "Annie is very ill. The doctor says it may be inflammation of the lungs. I am losing my head all alone. Princess Varvara is no help, but a hindrance. I expected you the day before yesterday, and now I am sending to find out where you are and what you are doing. I wanted to come myself, but thought better of it, knowing you would dislike it. Send some answer, that I may know what to do. The child ill, yet she had thought of coming herself. Their daughter ill, and this hostile tone. The innocent festivities over the election and this gloomy, burdensome love to which he had to return struck Vronsky by their contrast. But he had to go, and by the first train that night he set off home. Chapter 32. Before Vronsky's departure for the elections, Anna had reflected that the scenes constantly repeated between them each time he left home might only make him cold to her instead of attaching him to her, and resolved to do all she could to control herself so as to bear the parting with composure. But the cold, severe glance with which he had looked at her when he came to tell her he was going had wounded her, and before he had started, her peace of mind was destroyed. In solitude, later, thinking over that glance which had expressed his right to freedom, she came, as she always did, to the same point, the sense of her own humiliation. He has the right to go away when and where he chooses, not simply to go away, but to leave me. He has every night, and I have none. But knowing that, he ought not to do it. What has he done, though? He looked at me with a cold, severe expression. Of course, that is something indefinable, impalpable. But it has never been so before, and that glance means a great deal, she thought. That glance shows the beginning of coolness. And though she felt sure that a coolness was beginning, there was nothing she could do. She could not in any way alter her relations to him. Just as before, only by love and by charm could she keep him. And so, just as before, only by occupation in the day, by morphine at night, could she stifle the fearful thought of what would come if he ceased to love her. It is true there was still one means, not to keep him. For that she wanted nothing more than his love, but to be nearer to him, to be in such a position that he would not leave her. That means was divorce and marriage. And she began to long for that and made up her mind to agree to it the first time he or Stiva approached her on the subject. Absorbed in such thought, she passed 5 days without him, the 5 days that he was to be absent. Walks, conversation with Princess Varvara, visits to the hospital, and most of all, reading. Reading one book after another filled up her time. But on the 6th day, when the coachman came back without him, and she felt that now she was utterly incapable of stifling the thought of him and of what he was doing there, just at that time her little girl was taken ill. Anna began to look after her, but even that did not distract her mind, especially as the illness was not serious. However hard she tried, she could not love this little child, and to feign love was beyond her powers. Toward the evening of that day, still alone, Anna was in such a panic about him that she decided to start for the town, but on second thought wrote him the contradictory letter that Vronsky received, and without reading it through sent it off by a special messenger. The next morning she received his letter and regretted her own. She dreaded a repetition of the severe look he had flung at her at parting, especially when he would learn that the baby was not dangerously ill. But still she was glad she had written to him. By now Anna was admitting to herself that she was a burden to him, that he would relinquish his freedom regretfully to return to her, and in spite of that she was glad he was coming. Let him weary of her, but he would be here with her, so that she would see him, would know of every action he took. She was sitting in the drawing room near a lamp with a new volume of Taine, and as she read, listening to the sound of the wind outside, and every minute expecting the carriage to arrive. Several times she had fancied she heard the sound of wheels, but she had been mistaken. At last she heard not the sound of wheels, but the coachman's shout and the dull rumble in the covered entry. Even Princess Varvara, playing solitaire, confirmed this, and Anna, flushing hotly, got up. But instead of going down, as she had done twice before, she stood still. She suddenly felt ashamed of her duplicity, but even more she dreaded how he might meet her. All feeling of wounded pride had passed now. She was only afraid of the expression of his displeasure. She remembered that her child had been perfectly well again for the last day. She felt positively vexed with her for getting better from the very moment her letter was sent off. Then she thought of him, that he was here, all of him, with his hands, his eyes. She heard his voice, and forgetting everything, she ran joyfully to meet him. "Well, how is Annie?" he said apprehensively from below, looking up to Anna as she ran down to him. He was sitting on a chair and a footman was pulling off his warm overboots. "Oh, she is better." "And you?" he said, shaking himself. She took his hand in both of hers and drew it to her waist, never taking her eyes off him. "Well, I'm glad," he said, coldly scanning her, her hair, her dress, which he knew she had put on for him. All was charming, but how many times it had charmed him. And the expression that she so dreaded settled upon his face. "Well, I'm glad. And are you well?" he said, wiping his damp beard with his handkerchief and kissing her hand. "Never mind," she thought, "only let him be here. And so long as he's here, he cannot, he dare not cease to love me." The evening was spent happily and gaily in the presence of Princess Varvara, who complained to him that Anna had been taking morphine in his absence. "What am I to do? I couldn't sleep. My thoughts prevented me. When he's here, I never take it. Hardly ever." He told her about the election, and Anna knew how, by adroit questions, to bring him to what gave him most pleasure, his own success. She told him of everything that interested him at home, and all that she told him was of the most cheerful description. But late in the evening, when they were alone, Anna, seeing that she had regained complete possession of him, wanted to erase the painful impression of the glance he had given her for her letter. She said, "Tell me frankly, you were vexed at getting my letter, and you didn't believe me?" As soon as she had said it, she felt that however warm his feelings were to her, he had not forgiven her for that. "Yes," he said, "the letter was so strange. First, Annie ill, and then you thought of coming yourself?" "It was all the truth." "Oh, I don't doubt it." "Yes, you do doubt it. You are vexed, I see." "Not for one moment. I'm only vexed, that's true, that you seem somehow unwilling to admit that there are duties." "The duty of going to a concert?" "But we won't talk about it," he said. "Why not talk about it?" she said. "I only meant to say that matters of real importance may turn up. Now, for instance, I shall have to go to Moscow to arrange about the house." "Oh, Anna, why are you so irritable? Don't you know that I can't live without you?" "If so," said Anna, her voice suddenly changing, "it means that you are sick of this life. Yes, you will come for a day and go away as men do." "Anna, that's cruel. I am ready to give up my whole life." But she did not hear him. "If you go to Moscow, I will go too. I will not stay here. Either we must separate or else live together." "Why, you know that's my one desire, but to do that, we must get a divorce. I will write to him. I see I cannot go on like this, but I will come with you to Moscow." "You talk as if you were threatening me, but I desire nothing so much as never to be parted from you," said Vronsky, smiling. But as he said these words, there gleamed in his eyes not merely a cold look, but the vindictive look of a man persecuted and made cruel. She saw the look and correctly divined its meaning. "And if things have come to such a pass, it's a calamity," that glance told her. It was a moment's impression, but she never forgot it. Anna wrote to her husband asking him about a divorce, and toward the end of November, taking leave of Princess Varvara, who wanted to go to Petersburg, she went with Vronsky to Moscow, expecting every day an answer from Alexei Alexandrovich, and after that the divorce. They now established themselves together like married people. Part 7, Chapter 1. The Levins had been 2 months in Moscow. The date had long passed on which, according to the most trustworthy calculations of people learned in such matters, Kitty should have been confined. But she was still about, and there was nothing to show that her time was any nearer than 2 months ago. The doctor, the midwife, and Dolly, and her mother, and most of all Levin, who could not think of the approaching event without terror, began to be impatient and uneasy. Kitty was the only person who felt perfectly calm and happy. She was distinctly conscious now of the birth of a new feeling of love for the future child, for her, to some extent, actually existing already, and she brooded blissfully over this feeling. He was not by now altogether a part of herself, but sometimes lived his own life independently of her. Often this separate being gave her pain, but at the same time she wanted to laugh with a strange new joy. All the people she loved were with her, and all were so good to her, so attentively looking out for her, so entirely pleasant was everything presented to her, that if she had not known and felt that it must all soon be over, she could not have wished for a better and pleasanter life. The only thing that spoiled the charm of this mode of life was that here her husband was not as she loved him to be, as he was in the country. She liked his serene, friendly, and hospitable manner in the country. In the town he seemed continually uneasy and on his guard, as though he were afraid someone would be rude to him, and still more, to her. At home in the country, definitely knowing himself to be in his right place, he was never in haste to be off elsewhere, was occupied all the time. Here in town he was in a continual hurry, as though afraid of missing something, and yet he had nothing to do, and she felt pity for him. To others, she knew, he did not appear an object of pity. On the contrary, when Kitty looked at him in society, as one sometimes looks at those one loves, trying to see him as if he were a stranger, so as to catch the impression he must make on others, she saw with a panic even of jealous fear that he was far indeed from being a pitiable figure, that he was very attractive with his honesty, his rather old-fashioned, reserved courtesy to women, his powerful figure, and striking, as she thought, an expressive face. But she saw him not from without, but from within. She saw that here he was not himself. That was the only way she could define his condition to herself. Sometimes she inwardly reproached him for his inability to live in the town. Sometimes she recognized that it was really hard for him to order his life here so that he could be satisfied with it. What had he to do, indeed? He did not care for cards. He did not go to a club. Spending the time with jovial gentlemen of Oblonsky's type, she knew now what that meant. It meant drinking and going somewhere after drinking. She could not think without horror of where men went on such occasions. Was he to go into society? But she knew he could only find satisfaction in that if he took pleasure in the society of young women, and that she could not wish for. Should he stay at home with her, her mother, and her sisters? But much as she liked and enjoyed their conversations forever on the same subjects, Aline's, Nadine's, as the old prince called the sisters' talks, she knew it must bore him. What was there left for him to do? To go on writing his book? He had indeed attempted to do it, and at first he used to go to the library and make extracts and look up references for his book. But as he told her, the more he did nothing, the less time he had to do anything. And besides, he complained that he had talked too much about his book here, and that consequently all his ideas about it were muddled and had lost their interest for him. One advantage in this town life was that quarrels hardly ever happened between them here in town. Whether it was that their conditions in town were different, or that they had both become more careful and sensible in that respect, they had no quarrels in Moscow from jealousy, which they had so dreaded when they moved from the country. One event, an event of great importance to both from the point of view, did indeed happen, which was Kitty's meeting with Vronsky. The old princess Maria Borisovna, Kitty's godmother, who had always been very fond of her, had insisted on seeing her. Kitty, though she did not go into society at all on account of her condition, went with her father to see the venerable old lady and there met Vronsky. The only thing Kitty could reproach herself for at this meeting was that at the instant when she recognized in his civilian dress the features once so familiar to her, her breath failed her. The blood rushed to her heart, and a vivid blush, she felt it, overspread her face. But this lasted only a few seconds. Before her father, who purposely began talking in a loud voice to Vronsky, had finished, she was perfectly ready to look at Vronsky, to speak to him, if necessary, exactly as she spoke to Princess Maria Borisovna, and more than that, to do so in such a way that everything, to the faintest intonation and smile, would have been approved by her husband, whose unseen presence she seemed to feel about her at that instant. She said a few words to him, even smiled serenely at his joke about the elections, which he called our parliament. She had to smile to show she saw the joke. But she turned away immediately to Princess Maria Borisovna and did not once glance at him till he got up to go. Then she looked at him, but evidently only because it would be uncivil not to look at a man when he is saying goodbye. She was grateful to her father for saying nothing to her about their meeting Vronsky, but she saw by his special warmth to her after the visit, during their usual walk, that he was pleased with her. She was pleased with herself. She had not expected she would have had the power, while keeping somewhere in the bottom of her heart all the memories of her old feelings for Vronsky, not only to seem, but to be perfectly indifferent and composed with him. Levin flushed a great deal more than she when she told him she had met Vronsky at Princess Maria Borisovna's. It was very hard for her to tell him this, but still harder to go on speaking of the details of the meeting, as he did not question her but simply gazed at her with a frown. "I am very sorry you weren't there," she said. "It wasn't so much the fact that you weren't in the room. I couldn't have been so natural in your presence. I am blushing now much more, much, much, much more," she said, blushing till the tears came into her eyes. "But it's a pity you couldn't have looked through a peephole." The truthful eyes told Levin that she was satisfied with herself, and in spite of her blushing, he was quickly reassured and began questioning her, which was all she wanted. When he had heard everything, even to the detail that for the first second she could not help flushing, but that afterward she was just as direct and as much at her ease as with any chance acquaintance, Levin was quite happy again and said he was glad of it, and would not now behave as stupidly as he had done at the election, but would try the first time he met Vronsky to be as friendly as possible. "It's so wretched to feel that there's any man who is almost your enemy and whom it's painful to meet," said Levin. "I'm very, very glad." Chapter 2. "Do go, then, please, and call on the Bowles," Kitty said to her husband when he came in to see her at 11 o'clock before going out. "I know you are dining at the club. Papa put down your name. But what are you going to do in the morning?" "I am only going to Katavasov," answered Levin. "Why so early?" "He promised to introduce me to Metrov. I wanted to talk to him about my work." "He's a distinguished savant from Petersburg," said Levin. "Yes, wasn't it his article you were praising so?" "Well, and after that," said Kitty, "I shall go to the court, perhaps, about my sister's business." "And the concert?" she queried. "I shan't go there all alone." "No, do go. There are going to be some new things. That used to interest you so. I should certainly go." "Well, anyway, I shall come home before dinner," he said, looking at his watch. "Put on your frock coat so that you can go straight to call on Countess Bull." "But is it absolutely necessary?" "Oh, absolutely. He has been to see us. Come, what is it? You go in, sit down, talk for 5 minutes of the weather, get up and go away." "Oh, you wouldn't believe it. I've got so out of the way of all this that it makes me feel positively ashamed. It's such a horrible thing to do. A complete outsider walks in, sits down, stays on with nothing to do, wastes their time and upsets himself, and then goes away." Kitty laughed. "Why, I suppose you used to pay calls before you were married, didn't you?" "Yes, I did, but I always felt ashamed, and now I'm so unaccustomed to it that, by God, I'd sooner go 2 days running without my dinner than pay this call. One's so ashamed. I feel all the while that they're annoyed, that they're saying, 'What has he come for?'" "No, they won't. I'll answer for that," said Kitty, looking into his face with a laugh. She took his hand. "Well, goodbye. Do go, please." He was just going out after kissing his wife's hand when she stopped him. "Kostya, do you know I've only 50 rubles left?" "Oh, all right, I'll go to the bank and get some." "How much?" he said, with the expression of dissatisfaction she knew so well. "No, wait a minute." She held his hand. "Let's talk about it. It worries me. I seem to spend nothing unnecessarily, but money seems simply to fly away. We don't manage well somehow." "Not at all," he said with a little cough, looking at her from under his brows. That cough she knew well. It was a sign of intense dissatisfaction, not with her, but with himself. He certainly was displeased, not at so much money being spent, but at being reminded of what he, knowing something was unsatisfactory, wanted to forget. I have told Sokolov to sell the wheat and to borrow an advance on the mill. We shall have money enough in any case. Yes, but I am afraid that altogether it's too much. Not at all, not at all, he repeated. Well, goodbye, darling. No, I'm really sorry sometimes that I listened to Mama. How nice it would have been in the country. As it is, I'm worrying you all and we're wasting our money. Not at all, not at all. Not once since I've been married have I said that things could have been better than they are. Truly, she said, looking into his eyes. He had said it without thinking, simply to console her. But when he glanced at her and saw those sweet, truthful eyes fastened questioningly on him, he repeated it with his whole heart. I was positively forgetting her, he thought, and he remembered what was before them, so soon to come. Will it be soon? How do you feel? He whispered, taking her two hands. I have so often thought so, and now I don't think about it or know anything about it. And you're not frightened? She smiled contemptuously. Not the least little bit, she said. Well, if anything happens, I shall be at Katavasov's. Oh, nothing will happen, and don't think about it. I'm going for a walk on the boulevard with Papa. We're going to see Dolly. I shall expect you before dinner. Oh, yes. Do you know that Dolly's position is becoming utterly impossible? She's in debt all round. She hasn't a penny. We were talking yesterday with Mama and Arsini. This was her sister's husband, Lvov. And we determined to send you with him to talk to Stiva. It's really unbearable. One can't speak to Papa about it. But if you and he... Why, what can we do, said Levin. You'll be at Arsini's anyway. Talk to him. He will tell you what we decided. Oh, I agree to everything Arsini thinks beforehand. I'll go and see him. By the way, if I do go to the concert, I'll go with Natalie. Well, goodbye. On the steps, Levin was stopped by his old servant, Kuzma, who had been with him before his marriage and now looked after their household in town. Little Adonis, that was the left shaft horse brought up from the country, has been shod anew, but she is still lame, he said. What does your honor wish to be done? During the first part of their stay in Moscow, Levin had used his own horses brought up from the country. He had tried to arrange this part of their expenses in the best and cheapest way possible, but it appeared that their own horses came dearer than hired horses, and they still hired additional horses. Send for the veterinary. There may be a bruise. And for Katerina Alexandrovna, asked Kuzma. Levin was not by now struck, as he had been at first, by the fact that to get to Moscow from the Vodvisenka to the Svitsvedbrastik, he had to have two powerful horses put into a heavy carriage, to take the carriage a quarter of a versta through the snowy smush, and to keep it standing there 4 hours, paying 5 rubles every time. Now it seemed quite natural. Hire a pair for our carriage from the livery stable, said he. Yes, sir. And so, simply and easily, thanks to the facilities of town life, Levin settled a question which, in the country, would have called for so much personal trouble and exertion. And going out on the steps, he called a sleigh, sat down, and drove to the Nitkitskaya. On the way, he thought no more of money, but mused on the introduction that awaited him to the Peterburg savant, a writer on sociology, and what he would say to him about his book. Only during the first days of his stay in Moscow, Levin had been struck by the expenditure, strange to one living in the country, unproductive but inevitable, that was expected of him on every side. But by now he had grown used to it. That had happened to him in this matter, which is said to happen to drunkards. The first glass sticks in the throat, the second flies down like a hawk, but after the third they're like tiny little birds. When Levin had changed his first 100-ruble note to pay for liveries for his footman and hall porter, he could not help reflecting that these liveries were of no use to anyone, but they were indubitably necessary, to judge by the amazement of the princess and Kitty when he suggested that they might do without liveries, that these liveries would cost the wages of 2 laborers for the summer, that is, would pay for about 300 working days from Easter to the fast of Advent, and each a day of hard work from early morning to late evening, and that 100-ruble note did stick in his throat. But the next note changed to pay for providing a dinner for their relations, That cost 28 rubles, though it did excite in Levin the reflection that 28 rubles meant 9 shepherds of oats, which men would with groans and sweat have reaped and bound and threshed and winnowed and sifted and sown. This next one he parted with more easily. And now the notes he changed no longer aroused such reflections, and they flew off like little birds. Whether the labor devoted to obtaining the money corresponded to the pleasure given by what was bought with it was a consideration he had long ago dismissed. His business calculation that there was a certain price below which he could not sell certain grain was forgotten, too. The rye, for the price of which he had so long held out, had been sold for 50 kopecks, a shepherd, cheaper than it had been fetching a month ago. Even the consideration that, with such an expenditure, he could not go on living for a year without debt, even that had no force. Only one thing was essential, to have money in the bank, without inquiring where it came from, so as to know that one had the wherewithal to buy meat for tomorrow. And this condition had hitherto been fulfilled. He had always had the money in the bank. But now the money in the bank had gone, and he could not quite tell where to get the next installment. And this it was which, at the moment when Kitty had mentioned money, had disturbed him. But he had no time to think about it. He drove off, thinking of Katavasov and the meeting with Metrov, which was before him. Chapter 3. Levin had on this visit to town seen a great deal of his old friend at the university, Professor Katavasov, whom he had not seen since his marriage. He liked in Katavasov the clearness and simplicity of his conception of life. Levin thought that the clearness of Katavasov's conception of life was due to the poverty of his nature. Katavasov thought that the disconnectedness of Levin's ideas was due to his lack of intellectual discipline. But Levin enjoyed Katavasov's clearness, and Katavasov enjoyed the abundance of Levin's untrained ideas, and they liked to meet and to dispute. Levin had read to Katavasov some parts of his book, and he had liked them. On the previous day, Katavasov had met Levin at a public lecture and told him that the celebrated Metrov, whose article Levin had much liked, was in Moscow, that he had been much interested in what Katavasov had told him about Levin's work, and that he was coming to see him tomorrow at 11, and would be very glad to make Levin's acquaintance. "You're positively a reformed character, my dear, I'm glad to see," said Katavasov, meaning Levin in the little drawing room. "I heard the bell and thought, impossible. It can't be he at the exact time. Well, what do you say to the Montenegrins now? They're a race of warriors." "Why, what's happened?" asked Levin. Katavasov, in a few words, told him the last piece of news from the war, and going into his study, introduced Levin to a short, thick-set man of pleasant appearance. This was Metrov. The conversation touched for a brief space on politics and on how recent events were looked at in the higher spheres in Petersburg. Metrov repeated a saying that had reached him through a most trustworthy source, reported as having been uttered on this subject by the Tsar and one of the ministers. Katavasov had heard also, on excellent authority, that the Tsar had said something quite different. Levin tried to imagine circumstances in which both sayings might have been uttered, and the conversation on that topic dropped. "Yes, here he's practically written a book on the natural conditions of the laborer in relation to the land," said Katavasov. "I'm not a specialist, but I, as a student of natural science, was pleased at his not taking mankind as something outside biological laws, but on the contrary, perceiving his dependence on his surroundings, and in that dependence seeking the laws of his development." "That's very interesting," said Metrov. "To tell the truth, I began to write a book on agriculture, but studying the chief instrument of agriculture, the laborer," said Levin, reddening, "I could not help coming to quite unexpected results." And Levin began carefully, as though feeling his ground, to expound his views. He knew Metrov had written an article against the generally accepted theory of political economy, but to what extent he could reckon on his sympathy with his own new views he did not know and could not guess from the clever and serene face of the savant. "But in what do you see the special characteristics of the Russian laborer?" said Metrov. "In his biological characteristics, so to speak, or in the condition in which he is placed. Levin saw that there was an idea underlying this question with which he did not agree, but he went on explaining his own idea that the Russian laborer has a quite special view of the land, different from that of other people, and to support this proposition he made haste to add that in his opinion this attitude of the Russian peasant was due to the consciousness of his vocation to settle vast unoccupied expanses in the East. One may easily be led into error in basing any conclusion on the general vocation of a people, said Metcalf, interrupting Levin. The condition of the laborer will always depend on his relation to the land and to capital. And without letting Levin finish explaining his idea, Metcalf began expounding to him the special point of his own theory. In what the point of his theory lay, Levin did not understand, because he did not take the trouble to understand. He saw that Metcalf, like other people, in spite of his own article, in which he had attacked the current theory of political economy, looked at the position of the Russian peasant simply from the point of view of capital, wages, and rent. He would indeed have been obliged to admit that in the Eastern, much the larger part of Russian rent was as yet nil, that for 9/10 of the 80 millions of the Russian peasants, wages took the form simply of food provided for themselves, and that capital does not so far exist except in the form of the most primitive tools. Yet it was only from that point of view that he considered every laborer, though in many points he differed from the economists, and had his own theory of the wage fund, which he expounded to Levin. Levin listened reluctantly, and at first made objections. He would have liked to interrupt Metcalf, to explain his own thought, which in his opinion would have rendered further exposition of Metcalf's theories superfluous. But later on, feeling convinced that they looked at the matter so differently, that they could never understand one another, he did not even oppose his statements, but simply listened. Although what Metcalf was saying was by now utterly devoid of interest for him, he yet experienced a certain satisfaction in listening to him. It flattered his vanity that such a learned man should explain his ideas to him so eagerly, with such intensity and confidence in Levin's understanding of the subject, sometimes with a mere hint referring him to a whole aspect of the subject. He put this down to his own credit, unaware that Metcalf, who had already discussed his theory over and over again with all his intimate friends, talked of it with special eagerness to every new person, and in general was eager to talk to anyone of any subject that interested him, even if still obscure to himself. "We are late, though," said Katavasov, looking at his watch directly Metcalf had finished his discourse. "Yes, there's a meeting of the Society of Amateurs today in commemoration of the 50-year jubilee of Svintich," said Katavasov in answer to Levin's inquiry. "Peter Ivanovich and I were going. I've promised to deliver an address on his labors in zoology. Come along with us. It's very interesting." "Yes, and it's really time to start," said Metcalf. "Come with us. And from there, if you care to come to my place, I should very much like to hear your work." "Oh, no, it's no good yet. It's unfinished. But I shall be very glad to go to the meeting." "I say, my dear, have you heard? He has handed in a majority report," Katavasov called from the other room, where he was putting on his dress coat. And a conversation sprang up on the university question. The university question was a very important event that winter in Moscow. Three old professors in the council had not accepted the opinion of the younger professors. The young ones had registered a separate resolution. This resolution, in the judgment of some people, was monstrous. In the judgment of others, it was the simplest and most just thing to do, and the professors were split into two parties. One party, to which Katavasov belonged, saw in the opposite party a scoundrelly betrayal and treachery, while the opposite party saw in them childishness and lack of respect for the authorities. Levin, though he did not belong to the university, had several times already during his stay in Moscow heard and talked about this matter, and had his own opinion on the subject. He took part in the conversation that was continued in the street as all three walked to the old building of the university. The meeting had already begun, round the cloth-covered table at which Katavasov and Metcalf seated themselves. There were some half-dozen persons, and one of these was bending close over a manuscript, reading something aloud. Levin sat down in one of the empty chairs that were standing round the table, and in a whisper asked the student sitting near what was being read. The student, eyeing Levin with displeasure, said, "The biography." Though Levin was not interested in the biography, he could not help listening and learned some new and interesting facts about the life of the distinguished man of science. When the reader had finished, the chairman thanked him and read some verses of the poet Mint, sent him on the Jubilee, and said a few words by way of thanks to the poet. Then Katavasov, in his loud, ringing voice, read his address on the scientific labors of the man whose Jubilee was being kept. When Katavasov had finished, Levin looked at his watch, saw it was past one, and thought that there would not be time before the concert to read his paper to Metrov, and indeed he did not now care to do so. During the reading he had thought over their conversation. He saw distinctly now that though Metrov's ideas might perhaps have value, his own ideas had a value too, and their ideas could only be made clear and lead to something if each worked separately in his chosen path, and that nothing would be gained by communicating these ideas. And having made up his mind to refuse Metrov's invitation, Levin went up to him at the end of the meeting. Metrov introduced Levin to the chairman with whom he was talking of the political news. Metrov told the chairman what he had already told Levin, and Levin made the same remarks on his news that he had already made that morning, but for the sake of variety he expressed also a new opinion which had only just struck him. After that, the conversation turned again on the university question. As Levin had already heard it all, he made haste to tell Metrov that he was sorry he could not take advantage of his invitation, took leave, and drove to Lvov's.